Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Chukat. If you'll be in Jerusalem on Sunday, July 18th, or if you know anyone who will be there, then I invite you to check out the rhythm and energy of a day of learning at the Pardes Beit Midrash. The program's called Pardes for a Day, and it's only $10 or 40 shekels. It's open to men and women ages 19 and up. And during that day, you'll have the opportunity to learn classical Jewish texts in the Pardes style while experiencing chavruta learning, which is paired learning. You'll have the chance to interact in an open co-ed environment and meet Jews from all different backgrounds. So that's in Jerusalem on Sunday, July 18th, this couple of weeks from now. It's called Pardes for a Day. More information is available on the Pardes website, and look in the show notes for that URL. I hope you can attend. This week, Rabbi Michael Hatton discusses Chukat. Rabbi Michael Hatton is a Pardes faculty member. His focus is Tanakh. And now, Rabbi Michael Hatton.
Thank you, Larry. Parshat Chukat, the victory over Sichon and Og. Parshat Chukat, midway through Sefer Bimidbar, constitutes the chronological turning point of the book. The parsha begins with a lengthy description of the mysterious rites of the red heifer, a ceremony that restores a state of tahara to an individual who has come in contact with corpse tum'ah. The red heifer is burned along with a cedar, hyssop, and scarlet. The collected ashes are gathered and combined with spring water, and the mixture is sprinkled upon the petitioner on the third and seventh days. Whatever the deeper meaning of this service, it is thematically significant, for it offers closure to the wilderness experience. The generation that left Egypt condemned to perish for its indiscretions and tainted with the drabness of death takes its leave in this week's Parsha. With an unexpected suddenness, the generation poised to enter the promised land takes its place. In the 40th and final year of the wanderings, as the people reach the arid wilderness of Zin, Miriam perishes, soon to be followed by her brother Aharon and eventually Moshe himself. The people of Israel, thirsty and impatient to embrace their new destiny, had cried out for water and relief, and Moshe and Aharon sought God's counsel. These two brothers, who had faithfully led the people since the Exodus, are told by God to speak to the rock, so that it might give water to the parched masses. But they impetuously abrogate God's command and strike it instead. In consequence, they too are doomed not to enter the promised land. The commentaries offer a surprising array of explanations for God's unexpectedly harsh decree against Moshe and Aharon, none of them entirely satisfactory. But viewing the matter from a broader perspective, one can sense, if not justice, then at least some measure of balance to the troubling events. The demise of Miriam, the death of Aharon, and the standing sentence against Moshe all attest to their inviolable connection to the people, for the threesome had exercised prominent leadership roles ever since Israel had chafed under the Egyptian yoke. Moshe and Aharon had at that time strengthened their flock's flagging spirits, had taken up the struggle to liberate them, and had exulted in their eventual triumph as Pharaoh finally relented and set them free. Miriam, according to persistent traditions, had been instrumental in bringing forth their young, and had continued to encourage and inspire them at the banks of the Sea of Reeds. The three had never been absent from the people's lives, had never been far from their cries, had mourned their failures and rejoiced in their accomplishments. Moshe could legitimately claim, with some consternation, that he had been appointed as their nursemaid, to gently carry the people in his arms to the land that God had sworn to their ancestors, according to Bimidbar chapter 11, verse 12. And the other two could rightly share that assertion. How then could they, in good conscience, part from the people, detachedly observe them be devoured by the unforgiving dust, and then jubilantly accompany their children to the land flowing with milk and honey? Thus the fate of the three is sealed. although guiltless of the people's crime, of faithlessly embracing the report of the spies, they too must perish, to remain forever with their hapless kin interred on the eastern side of the Jordan. The people, the new generation raised by God on the scarcity of the wilderness and on its promise, finally begin their relentless march to Canaan. Skirting the territory of Edom, they encounter the hostile Canaanite king of Arad, who engages them in battle. The people of Israel vanquish him and approach the land of Moab. Encamping at the Wadi of Arnon, located midway along the length of the Dead Sea, they pause. Beyond this imposing dry riverbed canyon had once stretched the kingdom of Moab. But though Moabites had lost much of their ancestral territory to the menacing monarch that now exercised rule over these fertile lands, Sihon, the king of the Amorites. This imposing figure had some time earlier swept forth out of the Transjordanian highlands to seize Moabite territory, in a battle so fierce that it had been recorded by the balladeers of the day in lamenting stanzas, brimming with exaggerating descriptions of Sihon's prowess. Bamidbar chapter 21, verses 13 through 15 relate, "The people of Israel traveled and encamped beyond Arnon, in the wilderness past the border of the Amorites. For Arnon was the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore it had been recorded in the book of the wars of the Lord, Vahev was taken by storm, as were the tributaries of the Arnon. So too the rapids close by the dwelling of Ar, which are situated close by the border of Moab." Offering a novel insight, the Ramban explains that the so-called Book of the Wars of the Lord, mentioned only here and presumed lost, was authored by the wise men of those times, who would record the great battles, for such is the practice in every generation. The authors of such works would be called Moshlim, for they would employ the literary techniques of parable, mashal, and rhetoric. They would ascribe victories that to them appear to be miraculous to God, for such are truly his. The prowess of Sihon against the Moabites was wondrous in their eyes, and they therefore recorded it in this work. They spoke of the storm that Sihon had unleashed against the Moabite city of Vahev, against the towns that dwelt along the rapids of the Arnon, for God had destroyed it all in Sihon's sudden and violent onslaught. Commentary of the Ramban to chapter 21, verse 13. Significantly, the Torah freely quotes from this otherwise obscure work, that at least for the Ramban is nothing more than a tract of secular history, devoted to descriptions of temporal rulers and their bloody military exploits. At first glance, such a sighting seems jarringly incongruous, with one Talmudic sage even having the audacity to exclaim that, quote, "these verses are worthy of being burned," unquote, from the Talmud in Tractate Chulin, page 60b. Nevertheless, the Torah records the words of these balladeers with good reason, for we shall see that their poetry sheds light on the entire theme of the Parsha. The people of Israel, now positioned at Sihon's gates, request permission to traverse his territory, neither turning off the main road to trample field or vineyard, nor drinking from his wells, but rather remaining on the highway until passing through. Sihon, flushed with his recent victory over the Moabites, and unconvinced of Israel's benign intentions, miscalculates terribly, and ventures forth to engage them in battle in the wilderness at Yahatz. Quote, "Israel vanquished him by the tip of the sword, and inherited his territory, from the Arnon to the Yabok, to the land of Arnon, to the land of Ammon, for the border of the Ammonites was secure. Israel took all of these cities, and dwelt in all of the Amorite towns, in Cheshbon and in its satellites." For Cheshbon was the capital of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who himself had battled the earlier king of Moab and seized his lands to the Arnon. Therefore the balladeers, the Moshlim proclaim, "Come to Heshbon, for Sichon's city shall be built and established. A fire has gone forth from Heshbon, a flame from Sichon's city. It has consumed Ar of Moab and the governors of Arnon's heights. Woe is Moab! The people of Chemosh are lost, for he has rendered his sons refugees and given his daughters as captives to Sichon the Amorite king." Bimidbar chapter 21, verses 24 through 29. Thus, the initial victory of Sichon over Moab had been so astounding that the chroniclers of the day had described it as a storm and a fire that had laid Moabite territory waste and established Sichon as the uncontested ruler of the region. His expansive kingdom now extended along the entire upper half of the Dead Sea, continuing along the banks of the Jordan all the way up until the modern-day Golan Heights, where it bounded the lands of his even more sinister kinsman, Og, king of the Bashan. Who could dare to dispute with Sichon's ascendancy or to challenge his dominion? Who would dare to cross his path without showing deference to his power? Enter Israel, the people of God, a nation never well known for its martial traditions or menacing military might. Confronting Sichon's bellicose belligerence with a softly worded request for passage, they are summarily rebuffed and instead attacked with force. In a showdown so often played out over the course of their drawn-out and almost surreal history, the people of Israel remarkably prevail. The regional superpower is toppled, his iron grip is broken, and the surrounding nations look on in disbelief. The Torah's decision to record the words of the balladeers is an emphatic declaration that Israel's history is unlike the history of any other nation. It exists in a dimension that is only partially explicable in terms of power politics and global alliances, for its true destiny transcends them all. When God wills it, Moses the lawgiver trounces Sichon the tyrant, the selfsame chieftain who had only a short time earlier dispensed with the respectable kingdom of Moab as so much dry kindling. When God wills it, neither the force of the Pharaoh, nor the strength of Sichon, nor even the authority of Og can prevail. Bimidbar chapter 21, verse 33 through 35 relates, "The people of Israel turned and headed northward by way of the Bashan. But Og, the king of the Bashan, sallied forth with all of his people to battle them at Edrei. God said to Moshe, 'Do not fear him, for I will give him and all of his peoples into your hand. You shall do to him as you did to Sichon, the king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon.' The people of Israel smote him and his sons and all of his people completely, leaving not a remnant, and they inherited his land." Of course, with the downfall of these two, the gates to Canaan were thrown wide open. The Canaanites and Amorites, who dwelt in city-states that dotted the lands west of the Jordan, were thrown into a panic by the Israelite victory. The triumphant words that the people had sung on the shores of the Sea of Reeds come some 40 years earlier, concerning the trembling chieftains of Edom and Moab, the Canaanites who would melt from fright, were now coming true, bolstered immeasurably by the Israelite triumph. But all of it was for only one reason, that God would rule forever and ever. The purpose of the Israelite victory was not to cross the Jordan in order to found an empire after the storied example of Sichon and Og, but rather to craft a state predicated upon the bedrock of the Torah, the principles of ethics and morality, and the rule of God. In the biblical books, the remarkable victory over Sichon and Og looms very large. Moshe refers to it in the book of Devarim, chapter 2, verse 31, to chapter 3, verse 17. Rahav, The Givonites and Yehoshua all recall it in reverent tones in the book of Yehoshua. Yiftach the judge mentions it as an expression of God's might in the book of Judges. Yirmiyahu, the prophet of the first temple's destruction, paraphrases it to predict Moab's imminent fall at the hands of the king of Babylon. And Nehemiah, who is active at the end of the biblical period, mentions it to an audience that still remembers. The most famous reference of all, however, is that of the psalmist, who sings of the victory over Sihon and Og as part of the great song of thanksgiving, preserved in Tehillim, chapter 136. He guided his people through the wilderness, for his mercy endures forever. He smote great kings, for his mercy endures forever. He killed mighty kings, for his mercy endures forever. Sihon, king of the Amorites, for his mercy endures forever. Og, king of the Bashan, for his mercy endures forever. He gave their land as an inheritance, for his mercy endures forever. An inheritance for his servant Israel, for his mercy endures forever. He remembered us in our lowliness, for his mercy endures forever. He redeemed us from our oppressors, for his mercy endures forever. He gives food to all flesh, for his mercy endures forever. Praise the Lord of the heavens, for his mercy endures forever. Within the narratives of Parshat Chukat, the battles against Sihon and Og must be understood as the convincing demolition of the attitude of the spies. Their defeatist stance had been wholeheartedly endorsed by the victor's parents, the generation of the Exodus, in their mistaken belief that they were too weak to ever prevail against the Canaanite armies. The generation nurtured in the wilderness, imbued with trust in God's providence and confidence in his help, are abruptly introduced in this week's Parsha, and just as suddenly and surprisingly, they prevail against these Amorite kings. A Talmudic tradition that on surface reading seems to belong to the genre of the fantastic captures their astounding transformation. The Talmud, in Tractate Brachot, pages 54a through b, relates, Og, the king of Bashan, uprooted a mountain 3 Persian miles square. He lifted it over his head, and he prepared to throw it upon the people of Israel. The Holy One, blessed be he, brought kamtze, that chewed a hole in it, and the stone instead lodged around his neck. When Og attempted to lift it off of his neck, his teeth were extended in either direction, and he was unable to do so. Here, we have all of the trappings of a fairy tale. An imposing giant, his nefarious scheme, and the unexpected appearance of tiny, seemingly powerless creatures that in the end bring about the titan's utter downfall, as his threatening incisors are magically neutralized. It is the identity of the mysterious kamtze that is most intriguing. This word is often translated as ants, but in proper Aramaic, the word actually signifies grasshoppers, the very same creatures whose swarms can decimate fields laden with a harvest and reduce them to stubble. In the context of the wilderness narratives, however, the grasshopper has a more innocuous connotation, for it expresses a notion of minuscule insignificance and associated feebleness. The text relates in Bimidbar chapter 13, verses 32 to 33. The spy spoke to the people of Israel disparagingly of the land that they had toured. They said, "The land that we have traversed is a land that consumes its inhabitants, and all of the people who dwell there are of fantastic proportions. There we saw the primeval giants, the children of Anak and the Nephilim. We were as grasshoppers in our own eyes, and so were we in theirs as well." In effect, The Talmud's tale relates a much more profound truth. The people of Israel, who as freshly freed slaves had perceived themselves as helpless Lilliputians, incapable of exercising will or confronting destiny, were proverbial grasshoppers, just as the spies had perceptively remarked. 40 years later, however, a new generation was poised to enter the land, to finally slay the proverbial giants that had laid their ancestors low. Og, the king of Bashan, was not only a colossus in their corporeal sense, but also a looming reminder of the people's earlier insecurities and inability to trust in God's salvation. This time, though, the grasshoppers miraculously prevailed, and they remarkably ensnared the ominous Amorite king. Lest there be any doubt concerning this reading, two lines of evidence support it. Firstly, the Aramaic translation of the verse in Bimidbar, expressing the spies' insecurities, reads as follows. We were as grasshoppers in our own eyes, as kimtzin, the same word that is used as in the passage of the Talmud. Secondly, Og is the only biblical figure described as one of the primeval giants in Devarim chapter 3, verse 11. Just as the spies had described all of the land's inhabitants, for he was an archetype for their invincibility. The Talmudic tradition, therefore, relates that the grasshoppers in the end did prevail, and the spies' lack of confidence was overcome. In many ways, then, Parshat Chukat serves as the turning point of Sefer Bimidbar. For in its narratives, the people of the Exodus and their leaders pass on, to be substituted by their more resilient and faithful offspring. Israel emerges as a people ready to settle its land, to exercise its national will, and to prevail. How much there is for us to learn from the transformation. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Hatton. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.